as it was meant to be initially, to give somebody a chance to look on his own to find himself another job. At some point in that continuum from 0 to 65 weeks, I think it's sensible for the government to say, look, after this point, and I think 26 weeks a possible sensible point to say, you either begin to look further afield, or you go into this training program, or you start, and for the time being, take a public service job, and you can wait, but in the meantime, you're going to have some return to the society which is paying you. I don't think we can have what I would call indefinite entitlement programs without any requirements. Now, I would go further. I would even say with the AFDC mothers, many of whom have only a single child, many of them, and many of whose only single child is in school, that it would be better for them, better for the society, to have them work at least part-time close to their home, at a public library, at a hospital, in some kind of a governmental office, because I don't think that our society has ought to make a commitment to people to say that we will just hand out money to you indefinitely. I think some people ought to get some money because they cannot work. That's a different matter. But on these issues, we should begin to move. Now, in terms of how much do you want to do all at one time, while I consider it is very bad to push a lot of older people out of the labor market, which I think we're doing now, I would let that rest just a little bit till I took care of the youth and the heavy numbers who are on extended UI and maybe some part of the AFDC mothers. But I would surely not forget about those older people. I would surely not forget about some of the other groups that I've mentioned who have real claims for continuing work opportunities. So I would try to take Senator Humphrey's word about a process and try to move as expeditiously as possible with one chunk after the other.
Thank you for your comments. How long do you plan on keeping these young people involved in this type of a program? I feel we've got to exercise a certain amount of caution here. I think we can put them on a program and say you're there for a career and you're going to stay there. Are you talking about a short-term employment of an individual in a public service area?
Yeah, I'm talking, I think one of the big payoffs, from what I know, is the cooperative programs. We don't have enough of them. We've had them primarily in the private sector, and therefore they're just not enough because employers don't want to fool around with it. I would like to see an imaginative use of public service employment while youngsters were still in their attached to schools, whereby one could give them an opportunity to work part-time during the school year, full-time during the summer, and over 2 to 3 years, so that they would finally get off these school extended roles by 18 or 19, they would have something to offer in the private market. Yes, I'm not thinking of a permanent story.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask one more question to Dr. Kaiser, and that is really on the very troublesome problem of the youth, where we have such a concentration, where we have social consequences of enormous significance, and where we aren't finding answers at all. I'm one who has voted against a differential for youth in the Social Security minimum wage or on minimum wage questions for all these years on the theory that we are actually displacing an adult from a job by voting for the differential, and with the need for adults to be hired, I did not seek to displace them. That's a very high social cost to pay for creating jobs for youth. But now we're at this point where everything is changing, and the problem of young people without jobs is really extremely acute. Now, in Ms. Rivlin's statement here, she has three alternatives in terms of dealing with the problems of youth. One would be a minimum wage, special minimum wage for teenagers. One would be exemption from Social Security taxes, or thirdly, outright subsidies to firms hiring teenagers. And she suggests these as possible alternatives, and there are certainly others. Of these three, which would you consider most desirable, and if none of them would be desirable today, what answer do you give to the problem?
Well, I think you've been on entirely the right track in what you've done, and I don't want you to get off the track. I think you were right.
See, I'm thinking of getting off.
Well, I think you were right in voting against the differentials. Now, let me say why. This is a perfect illustration. Now, I'm not attributing this to you. This is a perfect illustration of the complete lack of planning, the complete unwillingness to look at the economy as a whole, and the complete unwillingness to see the interrelationships of problems. Now let me apply it to unemployment insurance, and let me apply it to this differential problem. If we were in a situation where we had 3 or 4% unemployment, I could see great merit in carving down the unemployment insurance benefits on the theory that there are a huge number of people on unemployment benefits because they would rather be there than on jobs. But when the true level of unemployment is 10.5%, and 1/3 of our plants are idle, and when our GNP is what it is, no sensible economist can attribute to the generous nature of the unemployment insurance system the reason why the people haven't got jobs. The jobs are the solvent. Let's create the jobs, and when it gets very low, that will be the priority time to consider whether the people on unemployment insurance are there because the jobs are there, but they don't want them. Now, let's look at it this way. You have a dilemma. If you start by saying that you're going to carve down the duration and benefits of unemployment insurance, which frankly I think are too low if a person is really unavoidably unemployed, if you start carving them down, where do you stop under that philosophy? Are you going, I'm not asking you this question, it's rhetorical. Are you going all the way back to the idea that maybe if we didn't have any unemployment insurance and didn't have any welfare, all of these 10% of the people who are unemployed would be looking for jobs? I think move on the jobs first, and in the meantime have an adequate protective system for people, 95% of whom are employed because there are no jobs. Now let me apply that to your minimum wage thing. There again, when Arthur Burns talks about minimum wages, everybody who has said here that minimum wage, the General Electric president surprised me, he said minimum wages are responsible for a majority part of the unemployment. Arthur Burns said a lot of it. There is not a responsible, objective study by the Labor Department or others that haven't shown that the minimum wage has helped the whole economy and has helped George, and it has done enormous things for my newly industrialized South. The lifting of the wage standard has been good for the whole economy. That's point one. Point two, you can't look at the minimum wage problem without looking at the whole wage problem. Now everybody has been putting out these regurgitations about wage inflation. Now I know what's happening to some people in the construction industry. But my goodness, even the Wall Street Journal admitted a few months ago that in any period of high level prosperity, and taking the situation as a whole, the real wage rates gains have lagged far behind the productivity gains, and this is one of the big problems of the economy. And this is not the time to cut back on it, and that portion of it represented by the minimum wage protection.
May I get to Congressman Ross Law? We're getting to the hour here, the witching hour. And John, I know that you have some questions that you want to ask. And then Congressman Wright has a statement that he wants to make. And then we're going to wind it up. Because listen, we could be here, and it's fascinating, and I must say that nothing I would like to promote more than a good argument here. And we've had some of it, because that's the only way we get any ideas. Go ahead, John, and you promote one.
Yes, that's true. I'll try not to use any weasel phrases.
And by the way, you are at liberty to ask to discuss this too.
Fine.
Well, thank you.
Ms. Ginsburg, I was interested in your statement. I was not here when you mentioned it the first time, that there's $47 billion presently being
billion.
Yes, I said billion. $47 billion in float, or whatever you want to call it, being spent to keep people unemployed. Did you get that figure from the government or from our committee, or where did you get that?
It's not quite that. It's Alice Rivlin's figure.
Oh, Alice's figure.
I'll tell you exactly.
It's a fascinating figure. I just wondered where you got it.
Yeah, no, it's our figure. We're very careful to use only the best data. I told her early that we live off of data. Here, I got it.
All right.
This comes from a report that she issued on the 15th of March called a report to the budget options for fiscal 77. and she has programs and policies aimed primarily at creating employment directly. She comes up with a little over $5 billion. Increasing the employability of workers, she comes up with $17.7 billion. And providing income assistance to unemployed individuals is $19 billion additional. And then she adds a little
extra. These are all annualized figures, I assume.
Yeah, these are annualized figures, I assume. And then she adds a little bit for the tax policy, which doesn't show up as expenditures, but shows up as loss of revenues, and that comes up to $47 billion. Now, there is included in that, just so there are no secrets.
Now, are these all just federal funds, or
federal
does it include
funds.
State and local government funds?
No, this is the federal part.
Federal funds spent, and you label it, to keep people unemployed.
No, not quite. It's to create employment, to increase employability, and to assist the unemployed. Those are the three categories that she uses, and I'm not going to improve on those. Let me simply say that the two figures you might not think are in there, that come up to $10 billion between them, is a figure for elementary and secondary education, which she puts under increasing the employability, and almost $5 billion of veterans benefits for skilled training. Well, that's perfectly legitimate view, but that's an expenditure of the federal government to try to help some people to get more employment.
Well,
that's how it gets up to $47 billion.
What triggered my questions to you is I thought I heard you say, and maybe I didn't, that you thought we were presently spending $47 billion to keep people unemployed. Did you mean to say that?
Oh, I'm sorry if I did. I surely didn't. But what I did want to say, and will now say more cautiously, is that with $47 billion of expenditures directed toward, one, job creation, two, employability, three, replacing income that people don't have because they're unemployed, we have a lot of scope to hopefully create a much higher level of employment opportunities for people who are unemployed. I wanted to suggest.
That certainly is a different concept than I heard, and I'm glad to get a clarification of that, because I was a little concerned that we were spending that much to keep people unemployed. That did bother me, if in fact that's what you said, that really did. I was interested, Mr. Ginsburg, in your comments about, I believe it was you, about productivity. Now, my understanding is we've had a tremendous amount of study done on the productivity of workers in the private sector. And I'm interested in your, and many times enters into labor negotiations. But unfortunately, until recently, we really haven't had much study done on the productivity of government workers. I understand in the state of Virginia, there is a county government that has gone into now doing studies on the productivity of government workers. Since we devote a substantial amount of money to pay federal workers, do you know of any productivity studies that have been or are now being done on the productivity of government workers?
Well, there is a special committee. I've seen the reports. The GAO had some kind of partial leadership in it. Mr. Morris, a former assistant controller general, had an active committee. It's an interdepartmental committee. There have been several years of work done now on the productivity of federal employees.
Do you think this would be worthwhile, since we're talking about creating, under this legislation and others, jobs in the public sector, to see just how productive these jobs really are?
I think it's essential, with the American economy being increasingly a service economy, and I would say, Mr. Congressman, that I don't really think we have good studies of productivity in the service sector, even though it's private. I mean, that part of the sector.
I think you're right.
I would argue that it's essential that we begin to do much more work on output measures in the service area. We did a little book in New York under Department of Labor contract called Where Have All the Dollars Gone? We looked at New York City's budget, 1961-1971, and then added the figures up to 1973. We've had the same population in New York, 8 million. And we had an increase in human resource expenditures from 61 to 73, from under 2 billion to over 7.5 billion. So we asked a simple question, how do you account for that? What happened? And we accounted for part of it in terms of inflation, and we accounted in part of it in terms of new services. We created community colleges and higher colleges, and we had more medical services. But a good part of it defied our ability to find out what went on with that, except that it was sopped up in terms of more providers. That is, more people doing, operating in the system without our being able to define any output at all. The fact that you have, let us say, two assistants to a teacher to teach a bunch of youngsters how to read better, until you look at whether they read better, you don't know whether the two assistants are doing any good or not. And we've had a lot of stuff, I regret to say, of that nature going on in the city. That is, we've assumed that putting more people on created more output. That was, let's say, in some places that was true, some places it might have been problematic, and in a lot of places we just don't see the output.
Well, I appreciate your comments. My feeling has always been that we've spent an awful lot of time talking about the productivity rate in the private sector, and if we're going to spend money in creating, quote, jobs in the public sector, and especially in some cases when those jobs cost more to put online, we ought to know if they're productive jobs and really creating worthwhile activity. Ms. Rivlin, we've had some discussion here by Mr. O'Malley about the problem of the small businessman that wants to pass his business on to his family, and sometimes he's forced to liquidate because of the high estate tax. On the and some effort to, Senator Humphreys mentioned, to lower that burden of taxation that occurs when there is a transfer of death. Have you had a chance to see what the impact would be of some of these bills that have been proposed to reduce the estate taxes?
No, we have not worked on that one.
Pardon? Well, I'm sure that, especially my friend Mr. O'Malley, would be delighted.
I did not refer to small business in my testimony because it was a 10-minute testimony that didn't refer to any specifics. It talked about the general new lines that economic policy has to take. But in longer studies, I've done a great deal of work on small business. I'm profoundly concerned about it. I think the tax laws should be made more favorable to small business. But let me get back to how it relates to full employment.
And do you agree with Mr. O'Malley that that would help keep the family job operation?
I agree completely, but let's also get back to the whole point of full employment. And this puts the problem of the small businessman in the same light as the problem of the young person and the black and the other minorities. There is absolutely no way in our economy, when the economy is in deep trouble, from preventing the vulnerable from getting hurt more than the powerful. In other words, if a ship sinks and you throw the people into the ocean, there is no way of preventing the strong swimmers from doing better than the weak swimmers. You've got to prevent the ship from sinking, or you've got to have enough lifeboats. Now, both the problem of the small businessman and the problem of the minority worker or the less skilled worker is essentially a problem of full employment, because all the statistics show that when you have full employment and when you have the economy growing at an optimum rate, the small businessman does relatively very well, and you do not have a tremendously high rate of business failures. Now, I'm not arguing against assuaging his lot when the economy is in trouble. Don't mistake me. I'm for changes in the tax laws and all that. But when you sink from full employment to 10% unemployment, and when a quarter of our plant or a third of our plants are unused, the small businessman is all the laws of the world are going to change that in major degree. It is full employment that changes it. It is the idea that we've got to get over the idea. You know, if we were really where we ought to be, I'd still be talking about an ideal situation, not the world. If there were more jobs than workers, and when there were more workers than jobs.
Do you agree with Mr. O'Malley that over-regulation by the federal government is strangling small business?
I think that's a fact. I think the biggest factor is the recession, the repeated recession.
Do you think then that we should begin to deregulate in those areas that clearly are not producing?
I wouldn't be prepared to state which, but I think it is.
How about OSHA?
What?
He mentioned OSHA as an example that's been a case where there's been overregulation.
I'm not familiar with all those details, but I do think there is need for an intense study of that problem, and I also do think that this full employment legislation that people are talking about, identify that as one of the problems, and also identify small business as one of the problems. But I still say most insistently that there's no palatable, large, meaningful solution for small business except a healthy economy. That's the biggest thing.
Well, Mr. O'Malley mentioned that one of the major problems that small business faces today, and he gave an example of the small businessman that had to invest in $20,000 in a new floor and then come in and change it because another inspector came in and took another point of view. And the U.S. News and World Report tells us that in a recent article that overregulation by government has caused an add-on cost to business, and he says it represents roughly 52% of the employment level, of probably $130 billion a year add-on cost that's charged to business as a result of the response to overregulation. Now, is that a significant enough fact?
I'm not going to be forced into making a wrong answer. I agree with what you say about regulation. I think it needs to be re-examined. But don't you tell anybody that if the government gets out of regulation, the small businessman is going to be helped much.
I'd just like to make one statement. One of the things that favorably impressed me about the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill, Section 105A, the Congress finds and declares that widespread duplication and contradiction among federal departments and agencies, the failure to establish long-term priorities, lack of adequate information on the impact of federal regulations and programs, and the lack of a process for developing more efficient alternatives for achieving the nation's priorities or impeding the federal government and efficiently implementing full employment and balanced growth policies. And I think that's a significant section of the bill. I think
there's another section, may I just point out, that cites that we require a review of existing government rules and regulations to determine if they still serve a public purpose and are properly designed, and an annual evaluation of 20% of the dollar volume of existing federal programs which are in effect each year, and the submission to Congress of a formal analysis of the economic and social impact value of each program. We start one-fifth of the programs at 0 point, so that there's a compulsory re-examination of every single program and all rules and regulations. That's in our bill. I think that it gets at the problem. I don't know if it would solve it, but it gets at it.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I got one more question. You ready to get some more?
Sure.
I tell you what, it's 5 o'clock.
That's what you said you were trying to write.
And I think that we've had the most patient and energetic and exciting panel that we've had in this conference. Let me express very quickly a note of personal thanks and a note of thanks on behalf of the committee. This was an experiment for us. We had the 30th anniversary of the Employment Act of 1946. We wanted to get a sort of a general review of the manpower policy, employment policy, basic monetary fiscal policy. Obviously, it's limited. These problems are so complex that we could be here for days and weeks. In fact, we had 100 days. We had 100 days in which hearings were held last year by this committee. So we think that we made at least some study. Out of all of this comes a vast amount of information. And out of the information, hopefully, will come some programs worthwhile. The countercyclical program, for example, was out of this committee originally. I've just noted that Senator Proxmire, who has been such a powerful force on this committee, asked the General Accounting Office to do this special study on productivity of government employment. And I've just been informed that one of my fellow townsmen out in Minneapolis, Mr. Wayne Thompson of the Dayton Hudson Corporation, as chairman of a special task force for the Committee for Economic Development, CED, has just published a the results of a study entitled Productivity of State and Local Government. So again, there are efforts being made in that field, but it's still all in the beginning stages.
It won't be just the production of paperwork.
Well, you can't tell, John, whether it'll be just paperwork or not. I think what we're really struggling with here are a number of new factors that we're not too acquainted with. But the point that has been brought out, and I believe I'm correct in saying that there's a general consensus, or a consensus which obviously is general, that there is a need of establishing the goal of full employment, namely that those persons who are able-bodied, who want to work, should have the opportunity of gainful employment at a decent wage. I believe that it is recognized that that one achievement would do a great deal to forward the social and economic progress of our country. I think it is also recognized after the discussions of these 2 days that the economic policy-making machinery of the federal establishment needs to be updated and I would say not only modernized but greatly improved. I think also we recognize that there needs to be closer cooperation between federal, state, and local. Congressman James Wright of Texas has been a very patient observer here this afternoon. The congressman has his own proposal in the field of employment, and I'm going to take these few minutes that we have remaining here to see, have him place in the record by his own presentation what he has in mind. And might I add that this record will remain open for a period of another week for other members of Congress and other persons who wish to submit statements or materials to have those included in the record. Congressman, why don't you go ahead and just tell us what you have in mind. I have a captive audience for you yet, and they're going to listen. They're delightful and generous people.
If I am impressed, as indeed I am, by the quality of the suggestions and information that's been brought to this panel, I am awed also by the scope of the problem. And I might say, Mr. Chairman, a bit abased by our inability in Congress thus far to come fully to grips with this problem. If I have any credentials at all, it would be that first, as a member of the House Committee on the Budget, I have become startlingly aware of the cost of unemployment to the nation and to the government itself. As a chairman of the conference committee that tried to hammer out upon the anvils of mutual compromise a jobs bill, and the floor leader of the forces in the House that succeeded only temporarily in overriding the veto of that bill, I have become aware of the frustrations of Congress in trying to come to grips in a meaningful way with this enormous problem. And so let me just say a few words about the cost of unemployment, about the frustrations that Congress faces in that connection, and then make a modest suggestion. Unemployment is too costly. We can't afford it. Well-accepted rule of thumb, acceded to, I think, in general by liberal and conservative economists alike, that each percentage point of unemployment that we suffer exerts an adverse impact upon our federal budget in the equivalent of approximately $16 billion, both in foregone taxes, because people who are out of jobs aren't paying income taxes, and in unemployment compensation and related welfare costs. If it is not quite fair of Professor Ginsburg to say that we're spending $47 billion to keep people unemployed, and I don't think that's what you meant, it is inescapable that it is costing the government $48 billion because the unemployment rate is some 7.5% instead of some 4.5%. And if we were able to bring it down to 3.5%, as is foreseen in the Humphrey Hawkins bill, we demonstrably could be saving some $64 billion this year that we otherwise were expending, and could reduce the anticipated deficit by some $64 billion in this fiscal year. There are many components of that problem, some of which were alluded to by Professor Ginsberg. Because our unemployment rate is so high, we're spending $19.4 billion this year on unemployment compensation. Because the unemployment rate has escalated so rapidly in the last 2 years, we're spending on food stamps $3.7 billion more than we were then. In 1974, we spent $4.5 billion on food stamps. This year, we spent $8.2 billion on food stamps and other agricultural feeding programs. Some $6 billion of that is food stamps. That's the total program cost. Veterans benefits went up $2 billion last year. Not totally because of the recession. Some of that related, I'm sure, to the great numbers of young men coming back from Vietnam and becoming for the first time eligible for benefits, such as educational benefits. But some of that must directly have been related to the fact that those young men could not find work, and the only thing they could do was to go back to school. So what I'm saying is we can't afford it. It costs us too much, and I'm far more. And for whatever reasonable, workable process we might establish together, take Americans off the unemployment rolls and put them on payrolls. I think that's where they want to be. I don't think the American worker wants an unemployment check or a welfare check from his government. I think what he wants is a paycheck for an honest day's work. I have that much faith in the American worker. And I think it's borne out by the experience Dr. Keisling mentioned during World War II. They want to work. They want a job. They want to feel useful. Every American. In addition to that, I want to say I've got confidence in the American business sector. I'm not one of those who believes that business is evil. I don't think it is evil. I think the American business community wants to provide jobs for American workers. And I think they would do so if given that much opportunity. Now, let me say just a little bit, very briefly, because time is fleeting, about the frustrations we have encountered thus far. I'm not trying to fight a battle over again. That's already been called. We tried to put together the kind of a bill that we thought would make some modest impact on this. $6.2 billion over 15 months for the thing Senator Humphrey referred to, developing this committee, the Countercyclical Revenue Sharing Program, coupled with an accelerated public works program to bring on the immediate construction of that great backlog of needed public works, not make work, not leaf raking. Public works that have been in the mill in every community throughout this country simply awaiting the funding to get started. And we mandated in that bill that those that would be eligible for assistance would have to be able to have on-site labor within 90 days. And we tried to do some other things. Well, the President found it objectionable, and because we failed by 3 votes in the Senate to override that veto, we don't have that problem. It wasn't a fantasy. It had its implications, but at least it was an attempt to spend less than a third of that $19.4 billion put some people to work. We thought it would have employed about 600,000 people. The President said otherwise. He said that it would cost too much per job. He said that it exalted the public sector over the private sector. He said that it wouldn't have produced the number of jobs we thought it would, that it would be too slow in taking effect, and that they would have been essentially dead-end jobs, and that they were jobs performing public works, although most of them were not on the public payroll. They would have been in the private sector, in the construction industry, where unemployment today hovers around 20%. And so I began to think, what in the world can we do to satisfy those objections, some of which, let's acknowledge, have some validity. What can we do to build employment incentives in the private sector and encourage the expansion of the private sector vis-a-vis the public, because that's what all of us want. It's those people pay the tax. What can we do to produce jobs at a lesser cost? The President said this would be $25,000 a job. I don't believe that. We costed it out on our econometric models at about half that figure, still too high. What could we do to produce jobs at maybe $2,000 a cost per new job? I began to thinking, what could we do, perhaps, to abate that question that we wouldn't really create new jobs? That it would be too slow in going into effect, or that they'd be dead-end jobs. And I come with this idea, which I offer to you, not as a panacea, but as a proposal, a suggestion. Not as a substitute for the other stimulative things that I think we're going to have to do, but maybe as a supplement to them. I built upon my experience in 1962 or 3, was it, Hubert, when President Kennedy called a bunch of us down there and said 7% investment tax credit is going to bring money into the government in the long run, not going to cost us. I want it to be. I said, Mr. President, I'll support your program because I think we need to stimulate the economy. We need to stimulate the private sector. We need to encourage them to invest in expansion and better processes and thereby have more productivity and employ more people. I thought to myself, don't try to tell me that's going to make money. But it did. He was right. So I began to think this, and I throw it out to you for what it's worth. It may have some bugs in it. If so, think about it and crank him in the computer. Why wouldn't it make sense, in addition to the other things we're trying to do, the public works jobs and so forth, if we were to have a program aimed at the private business sector? Little businesses, Mr. O'Malley, as well as big. Business of all kinds, any kind of a private employer, any farm, any business, in manufacturing, in wholesaling, in retailing, in the service trades, wherever, let them all participate. And make available to any private employer an employment incentive grant for each new person that he put on the payroll. It would have to be an expansion of his payroll, not a replacement for someone else. And it would have to be somebody who'd been out of work for 4 months and was actively trying to find work. He'd have to certify the watch. Such grant, I think, might consist of approximately one-third of the first 6 months' pay for this individual, or $2,000, whichever is the greater. And for the second 6 months, so that we phase it out, one-fourth of that individual's pay, or $1,500, whichever is the lesser. So that the maximum exposure the government could have on a new job created for an individual who's been out of a job and wanting a job would be $3,500. And that would indemnify to the maximum extent up to a $12,000 job. That's all you'd pay that much. The average job, I'm told, is about $7,000 job. If this were to go into effect, and if we were to stimulate the creation of jobs paying an average of $7,000 a year in big and little businesses and employment organisms throughout the country, the average cost of per job stimulated would be $2,000. Now, if we were to assume that that were the case, a $2 billion investment for 15 months would produce 1 million new jobs. 1 million. If we further assume that that's the case, and further were to assume that only two-thirds of these people would be taken off the unemployment rolls, and if we were to assume that each of those taken off the unemployment rolls would save the government $3,000, although the average cost per enrollee is $4,000 a year, we would save $2,000 for each individual. And if further we were to assume that that individual making $7,000 were paying taxes at only $1,100 a year, which I think is about the norm, we would be earning another billion and a half. And in other words, our $2 billion investment would net the government a billion and a half because it would bring in $3.5 billion. It would cut our unemployment compensation cost by $2 billion, and it would bring us $1.5 billion more in tax. Now, that may sound glib and superficial, and I know there are a lot of faults and flaws that you can pick in it. It would depend upon the capacity of business to avail itself of this, but I think we're beginning to go into an expansionary period. If we could stimulate those businesses, big and small, which are on the very precipice of decision, whether or not to expand, whether or not to go into a new market, whether or not to try to go into a new product, whether or not to buy some new machinery that will let them employ some more people. And if we were able to reduce their initial labor cost so as to free up some of their capital to let them invest in this additional machine, I think it could have a long-term and lasting effect on a lot of these jobs. Some of them might be dead-end jobs, but most of them wouldn't be Because for every dollar of federal expenditure, you'd be mandating that the private employer put up $2.50 in that first year. And every billion that you put out in federal government will result in $2.5 billion being invested in jobs by private industry. And I don't believe that business would go into it unless it saw a reasonable expectation that that job could be a continuing job, that it could be self-sustaining and pay for itself. And so I think a lot of those jobs would be continuing jobs. I offer that to you just as a suggestion. I'm groping like all of us. I don't know the answer. And there may be better answers. I'm for the Humphrey Hawkins Bill. I'm also trying to help find a few ways that we can get there from here. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I've taken 10 minutes.
I want to thank you. Does anybody here want to make a quick comment?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
How would you expect to inject this into the system fast enough so that it would?
Well, I think it'd have to be made available immediately. I think it'd have to be made available with minimal red tape. I think it'd have to be simplified. I think you'd have to crank it through an existing agency. Now, I would suggest, though I'm not hard and fast on this, that it might be the EDA, Economic Development Administration, which for several years has been in the business of making loans and grants to private as well as public officials.
And that's my administrator.
Does a good job. I think that's probably the way it ought to be done.
I just wanted to say to the congressman that I think it would be worthwhile for him to get in touch with Dr. Charles Stewart, who did a study for the commission, our commission on the West European efforts. And the Germans have tried something specifically like this, and I think maybe the French also. And we are holding a conference with these Western Europeans early in June at Brussels, and we'll report back to you as to what we learned, because that's part of our agenda with these Western Europeans. But you could get some early input from Dr. Charles Stewart, who is a consultant around town.
I'm very much interested in this. Mr. Spring?
In Massachusetts, they have a $500 tax write-off from your tax bill, not from your taxable income, for every new employee you hire. Had that for several years. Part of the mass incentive taxes, which they put through the legislature up there. We did a study of something like 65% of the firms that had applied for that and found that in interviews with them, they were firms that without exception, were going to expand anyway. Happy to take that money, but they were going to expand anyway. So you have a really ticklish problem, like with substitution in the public sector, of having to pay for jobs, which, in my judgment at least, is that jobs are a function of demand for your final product. If you're making airplanes, you hire people to make airplanes. If you're making Ford cars, you hire people to make Ford cars. The only thing you might influence would be a decision to hire more people rather than more machinery. There might be something in that.
Labor intensive.
But I think that's a... But there's also the Swedes are thinking about that. There's a paper that was presented back to this committee.
That's right.
On efforts to fight stagflation. But basically, I think what they're talking about is a general, across-the-board help to all industry. I mean, they're frank about it. There's going to be some substitution.
Just helping with the wage bill
of industry across the board.
To employ new people. And you may be right. It might be taken advantage of by some businesses going to employ more people anyhow. You could say that, though, for the investment tax credit or any of the other.
That's right. Any kind of tax credit.
Do you have anything on that?
Costly than this one. So my feeling is that there should be a more detailed study of the likely wastage in the process. Apart from that, some kind of direct employment subsidy, which is for this month, may be a way of getting economic recovery go a little faster. I don't think, however, we should lose sight of the fact that we are now in a recovery already, and that firms are hiring much more.
Well, there are some places, Doctor, but in my home state, which is considered one of the more stable economic states, we never get quite as high at the high period or as low as the other. We just added 34,000 people to unemployment rolls last month. The projection is now for the month of March, it'll be worse. And, you know, I don't take any comfort in that. That's why these general figures, they bug me. I have to represent the people in Minnesota. And we got big companies out there. We've got Honeywell out there, we have Cargill out there, we have Control Data out there. We have a lot of big companies, Univac, IBM, and so on. But we had problems, you know, and these are good workers. I'm not, you know, nobody can, you can't go around and put the quotes around these folks. These are good old Scandinavians and Germans and Swedes, and they all love to work, and they really do like it. And they're just as unhappy as can be. And I represent that constituency. What do I tell them?
Well, these are very real problems. Let me make it clear that I'm sympathetic to congressman rights.
But they don't want sympathy. They want a job.
No, I'm sympathetic to congressman rights, but also to the workers, too. But I think, though, we have to recognize that in an economy that's growing anyway, the kind of proposal that you mentioned here can cost an awful lot of money while not really doing much to stimulate the recovery that is on the way anyway. And I would be very interested to hear more about Professor Spring's evaluation of the Massachusetts idea of how many additional jobs it actually created per dollar spent.
Mr. Chairman, might I respond in 30 seconds? I think what the professor said may be true. We are in a beginning of an expansionary period, and I rejoice in that to the extent that it exists. But if we take the administration's own estimates and calculations, we will just end up, after 20 months of recovery, at the point which has been the very bottom of all of our post-war recessions. And I'm concerned that it isn't good enough. You know, I don't want to take from the administration or from anybody else the rate of success that's come along. I think maybe Congress came a modest amount of that, some of the initiatives we've done. But I don't think it's good enough. We've got 7 million people still out of jobs.
I would agree
strongly with you. I would suggest, though, that there are things American industry makes this country desperately needs and people in poverty need most of all. And that I think that a more promising way, so you can see your final product, where you're not putting money out, well, maybe it'll create more jobs someplace, and other companies that are expanding anyhow just can take the money. If you really concentrate on what this country needs to use to grow and to be strong, and that's really part of the plan, that's really what Leon Kaiser's been saying all afternoon, that then you can think it through and not just be guessing. Think it through and not just be guessing.
All right, this is great. We have an insatiable appetite for a good discussion and argument and proposals. I want to thank Congressman Wright. I don't know whether the proposal has problems and bugs in it that are beyond repair, but I think that it's another one of the many suggestions that we get that we ought to examine. And I'm sure the CBO is examining these projects as well, so that we have a number of agencies in our government now working at it. I'll tell you what I really think is necessary. I think what is necessary is a desire to experiment rather than a desire to say no. And one thing that comes through here is, as Congressman Wright was making clear, is the incredible cost of unemployment. That was in dollars. Nobody said anything about what it cost to incarcerate somebody for crime. What the tragic cost is in human life and in the human condition. And the recession, what it's doing to our cities, what it's doing to social services around in our localities. So what bothers me is that we have gotten into the syndrome of saying, well, we mustn't promise too much and we mustn't expect too much. I want to tell you what I find that to be. So I'm a parent. Whenever I told my child, I was a little bit afraid to go without very good grades, not because I really enjoyed studying, but because there was a standard that I was. There was another standard that no matter how late I stayed out, I got up early. And I once asked my dad, as a coffee, why are you so tolerant about me hanging around late nights and going out to the dance and all that sort of stuff, getting in 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning? But he said, well, I figured if you didn't have enough sense to know that you couldn't get out, couldn't come in the middle of the night and still get up and had to get up early at 6 o'clock in the morning, you weren't worth saving anyway. And there are certain kinds of disciplines that are rather important, you know. With that little friendly homespun note, we'll say good night and thank you very much.